Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma and I'm a Senior Visiting Research Fellow at the Institute. I'm today joined by Marshall Hall, who's a Senior Research Associate at the OIS, to discuss his recent paper, Gas Production from the UK Continental Shelf, an Assessment of Resources, Economics and Regulatory Reform, that was recently published by the OIES. Marshall, great to see you. Good morning to you.
Morning.
To start, why can we just give our listeners an insight as to why this paper has been written at this time?
Well, the UK upstream industry has been through, since about 2014, a period of really quite fundamental change in taxation, in the regulatory regime. It went through a dramatic cost reduction exercise between 2014 and 2017.
Right.
And I think middle of last year, it seemed to me an appropriate time to review what had happened and to assess whether those changes were having any discernible effect on existing operations and the longer term outlook for gas production in particular.
So it's quite timely, isn't it, really? It's a timely piece of research.
Well, I think there's a, I hope so, but there's, it's an opportunity, I think, we've now got a little bit of time to see how the new regulator, the Oil and Gas Authority, is operating, what it's hoping to achieve. It's a bit too early to say definitively whether the regulatory changes have been will be successful in the long run, but I think it's a good opportunity to review what's happened.
Well, good. We'll come to that in a minute, but before we kind of get into the details of the regulator and the change in that, can you perhaps just give us a high-level approximation of the current oil and gas reserves versus production levels, I should say, versus the previous higher levels, and also maybe versus other countries, to kind of give us a scale as to what we're talking about? You know, is the UK CS in decline, or is it in heading for closure?
Well, it's in decline, but briefly, there has been, in the last 5 years, there's been an upturn in gas production, as there has with oil. So there's been a temporary reversal of what is, I think, widely expected to be a long-term decline in production.
And we'll talk about that in a minute as to why that's happening. Yeah.
2018, UK continental shelf produced 41 billion cubic metres.
So 41 BCM,
35 of which roughly went into the onshore national transmission system.
Right.
You know, destined for the UK. Yeah.
And how much, what percentage kind of UK gas demand is that then?
Well, UK gas demand the last 3 years has been pretty stable around 80 BCM. So it's something just under half of gas, natural gas consumed in the UK comes from the offshore.
That's actually, you know, quite a large percentage. And we'll come to that a little bit more. But why don't we talk about the outlook for oil and gas production in the UK, United Kingdom Continental Shelf, or UKCS? You know, you say it's improved since 2015. Why is that?
Well, those changes I talked about, I think, have been quite fundamental. I would place a good deal of emphasis on what you might call the hard economics of production of oil and gas on the in the North Sea, on the continental shelf. And it is important that we consider oil and gas together, because 2/3 of UK gas production is associated gas.
Okay,
only 1/3 is dry gas.
Yeah.
And I think that's in trying to assess what's likely to happen in the future, we have to bear in mind that it's very difficult to talk about a set of gas economics separate from combined oil and gas economics in the North Sea. Mm-hmm. We're going to see, I think, we're going to see in the next few years a renewal of the decline in production that we've seen since 2000.
Right.
In 2000, gas production was 115 BCM, so we're not much more than about a third of the peak production that we've seen in the past.
Well, we're not going to get back up to those levels, are we?
No, I think we're in a plateau, or what I would describe as a plateau period at the moment, between about 2017 and 2021. Thereafter, I think the decline will resume. By 2035, the Oil and Gas Authority, which is the best place to make these judgments, because they have access to all of the subsurface information and the expenditure plans of companies, are suggesting that production will fall by 2035 to about 16 BCM.
Okay.
And the range of estimates, private estimates, lies roughly between about 8 BCM and 20 BCM by that time. So it is declining, and I don't think unless there are some extraordinarily large discovery of gas resources in the next few years, I think it's difficult to envisage that decline is going to be reversed.
But the decline rate has slowed down. But I think the question I'd just like to follow up with, if I can, is, you know, was it the establishment of the new statutory objective to achieve the maximum economic recovery of UKCS resources, mere UK, that really drove the increased hydrocarbon production in the UKCS? And how important has mere UK been? It seems to me it's come rather late in the production cycle of the UKCS.
Well, I don't think we can attribute the increase that we've seen in oil and gas production between 2014 and 2018
right.
to the new regulator
right.
Or the new the MER UK, maximising economic recovery of UK offshore oil and gas resources.
Yeah.
I think it's too early to attribute any contribution to that change of law and change of regulation.
Mm-hmm.
But what the OGA in implementing its duty to pursue MER UK is doing, I think, is to lay the foundations for what might be a higher level of production through the 2020s and 30s than would have been the case otherwise.
Right, okay.
But there is a fundamental problem about how we will ever be able to identify the contribution of the new of the OGA because we won't know what would have happened otherwise.
Yeah.
You know, the problem of counterfactuals.
yes.
It's I would say so far that I think it's taken a sensible, pragmatic approach to its task.
Yeah.
It's made some creditable, sensible changes to the licensing regime.
Mm-hmm.
It's instituted a regular stewardship survey of operators to try and get more information from them to inform.
So they've been quite proactive, haven't they? As a new regulator,
they have been, but they've been very careful. I think I have described them in the paper as so far having behaved like a behavioural regulator. They're
yes.
trying to encourage and cajole companies to improve their asset stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
That's physical above ground assets
mm-hmm.
as well as subsurface resources.
Mm-hmm.
But they've been very wary about using their really quite their new powers
mm-hmm.
given to them under the Energy Act 2016. They've kept them in reserve,
mm-hmm.
as it were, as an implied letting the industry know that they have these powers, but they've been very careful about not using them. They preferred to negotiate and control and influence behaviour to promote cooperation between operators to achieve what it wants. It remains to be seen whether that approach can continue to work.
But it's interesting because in your paper you did actually say, to quote, the UK tax regime offers no particular fiscal incentive for exploration of its kind, which exists in Norway. And so I just immediately wonder, after what you said, why? Why aren't there kind of greater incentives?
Well, it's important to consider the legal and regulatory changes associated with MER UK and the creation of the OGA, together with the tax reforms. Now, the Wood Review, completed in 2014, did not look at tax, but the Treasury, the government, which remains responsible for taxation, conducted a review of taxation separately.
Right.
One of the greatest challenge facing the OGA at the moment is to try and revitalise exploration, which has been lamentably low, at low levels through much of this decade. Sir Ian Wood, when he conducted his review in 2014, said that the exploration activity at that time, 2013, 2014, was completely insufficient to achieve the recovery of the known resources on of the full potential of the UKCS.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, exploration activity has actually declined further. In 2018, we had only 8 exploration wells drilled and only a further 9 appraisal wells.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the lowest level of exploration and appraisal
that's
activity
remarkable
since 1965,
yeah.
the beginning of exploration activity on the continental shelf.
Yeah.
So this is the key challenge facing the OGA, and it's taken some steps already to try and, through changes to the licensing regime, there's been government funding of exploration, there's a new national data repository which will make a lot of information, subsurface and surface information, available to prospective investors. So a lot of the things needed to promote exploration have been done.
But are there also fiscal incentives, I imagine, as well?
Well, not particularly. No. The fiscal changes that were implemented in 2015-16 have simplified the system, but there is no specific, as the paper, as you point out, there is no particular fiscal incentive for exploration in the UK, unlike Norway. Yeah. In Norway, if you, as a new entrant, without any existing production, if you finance a well and it's unsuccessful, you get your costs of exploration reimbursed to you up front.
So you don't? Do you think you'll have similar incentives then in the UK?
Well,
I think we should have.
This has been considered. I mean, some of the industry have called for similar fiscal incentives. They are contentious in Norway. I think they would be equally contentious if they were introduced in the UK. But I think there will be a period of a few years now to see whether the non-fiscal, the improvement in what you might call the background conditions for investment, are sufficient to stimulate new activity, new investment and appraisal. And the OGA is... the initial signs are promising. I think this year we will see a pickup in exploration and appraisal activity. Somewhere between 20 and 30 wells will be drilled in 2019. So things are improving. That's partly been stimulated, I think, not just by greater interest in recent licensing rounds introduced by the OGA, but also, of course, the success, the discoveries made west of Shetland and in the central North Sea last year.
Exactly.
So, there's nothing promotes success like exploration success.
Well, why don't we talk about the future and look at maybe the drivers to increasing resource discovery and production in the future? And hinging around that, I expect, is, you know, the question, you know, will the North Sea always be a high-cost producing region?
I think it will probably remain relatively high cost, and that's because environmental standards are relatively high, similar to those in Norway and the Netherlands.
Yeah.
The average discovery size and the average size of producing fields has got progressively smaller since the 1980s, so the underlying economics of development of known of discovered resources, I think, becomes more difficult.
Yeah.
There is this steady, I think, in any mature, highly mature province, and not all of the UKCS is highly mature, but in those areas of the North Sea which are mature, there is a steady deterioration in underlying production and exploration economics. But it's important to note that the cuts in taxation to the lowest levels in 2016, to the lowest levels that we've seen on the in the North Sea in the history of production, I think have stimulated new interest in the UKCS, not yet translated completely into project approval and commitments to drill.
But you think it could
new wells? But I think it could. I think the background, the conditions have been laid through lower taxation, and above all, the reduction in costs, and that some of that the industry, the operators themselves deserve credit for cutting their costs. Drilling rig rates have fallen, of course, since the peaks we saw earlier this decade. So the background is much more favourable for future exploration.
But something I've read about quite often is about decommissioning costs. So I just wonder, you know, are the risks of these potential costs a high risk factor for potential investors? And also, what about premature decommissioning? Is that a real risk?
Well, the estimated cost of decommissioning the 300-odd fixed installations out there, offshore UK, is estimated currently by the OGA to be about £50 billion in current terms.
Right.
That's decommissioning expenditure is gradually rising. It's running at just over £1 billion a year at the moment. Mm-hmm. Between 2025 and 2035, which will be the peak, it might be running in... at something north of 2, perhaps even 3 billion per year. The important point about decommissioning costs to recognise is that the UK tax system has always granted tax relief to operators to meet their end-of-life liabilities after the cessation of production and the final decommissioning. The OGA does not, strictly speaking, have responsibility for decommissioning. That remains with the government, with the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy. But the OGA is taking very seriously its commitment to try and reduce the costs of decommissioning. And the simple reason for that is that the public purse, the exchequer, the government, is going to be bearing a substantial share of those of that 50 billion spent over the next 30 years. And that's one of the I think the important motivating factors behind the reforms of 2014 to 16, both the fiscal reform and the creation of the OGA. It was seen to be essential to try and defer decommissioning of facilities before and to minimise the risk that remaining resources would be stranded by the decommissioning, in particular of infrastructure. So there is a, one might say, the large part of the value created in the, on the continental shelf in the last decade has by, is simply created by deferring expected decommissioning, pushing that expenditure back. And that is expenditure which is, as I said, going to be shared by government through lost tax revenue and tax reliefs and even tax repayments in some cases, and by the operators themselves.
It's interesting, because one of the things, talking about, you know, the uptake in exploration and also in production, and it strikes me that, you know, we are potentially talking about different types of potential investors. You know, investors and operators operating in mature producing regions such as the UK CS. Does it attract different types of investors, smaller companies rather than the bigger companies? And if they are smaller companies, are they going to get hit for this liability you're talking about?
Well, there is a change in the the composition, the ownership structure of assets, and that's produced exploration assets, producing assets, and infrastructure. We're seeing, as we've seen for a, for some time, and longer than a decade or more, that the oil majors who were responsible, the large international independents and the oil majors that were responsible for developing the North Sea resources in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, have withdrawn capital. They've sold assets. We've seen some notable asset sales from the likes of BP, Shell, Conoco recently. They've remained present on the continental shelf, but increasingly focusing on the less mature areas like the west of Shetland, where their skills and their capital and their technology can be deployed to greatest benefit. They've left some of the more mature areas. They've put assets up for sale, and we've seen the arrival of new independents, some of them backed by private equity. That doesn't necessarily represent a risk for decommissioning. The government is very wary of the possible risk of unfunded liabilities, and it has an option, which it's exercised already, to require operators to hold, to set aside funds to meet future obligations if there is any doubt about their ability to fund it from their existing existing operations. So there are precautions that the government can take. They're helped in that regard by the new regulator, the OGA, which is seeking to get to develop a decommissioning industry to keep the costs of decommissioning down.
Well, let's kind of, you know, perhaps look at it from the negative perspective, if I may, and kind of ask the question, you know, what are the risks that could basically stop continued gas production or even stop any increase in production, you know, from the UK continental shelf? And also, you know, how do you think the new chairman of the OGA, Tim Egger, who we mustn't forget was energy minister in the 1960s, will approach the challenge of the declining production? So what are the blockers that could stop it?
Well, I think the principal risks to the future production of both oil and gas on the continental shelf are largely economic. If there is a period, I mean, talking about gas in particular, if there's a continuation of this current period of relatively low gas prices, then you would be we would rightly anticipate an earlier decommissioning of some of the production in, for example, the dry gas areas of the southern North Sea earlier than we would otherwise. So it is vulnerable. There are parts of the continental shelf which are vulnerable to a protracted period of low prices, and I would suggest that gas producers, although it's very difficult to given the given how closely held a lot of financial information is about individual producers and individual fields, I think gas producers are probably a bit more vulnerable than oil producers. Oil production looks a little bit more robust and a little bit.
But you said that earlier on, it's associated, a lot of these says 2/3 is associated gas. So that's a positive, isn't it, as well? Because if the oil production is going to drive the gas production.
Well, the central North Sea, northern North Sea areas of primarily associated gas production are, could perhaps live through periods of extended low gas prices mm-hmm. in a way that perhaps those in the southern gas basin, which are producing almost exclusively gas, could not. Mm-hmm. So we have to look at, as I said, for most of the continental shelf, you have to look at oil and gas together.
Yeah.
As far as the new regulator is concerned, I mean, it's been, I think, as I suggest in the paper, I think the OGA under Chief Executive Andy Samuel has taken a lot of sensible steps.
Right,
it's aroused the it's taken a couple of contentious steps over mm-hmm. in some area plans and regarding mm-hmm. acceptable returns for new investment, but I think broadly it's earned the respect mm-hmm. of the industry, and people are broadly content, I think, to work under the aegis of the OGA.
And you're seeing the investments, as you've said yeah. earlier on, presumably that's in response to that.
Yes, and I think there's although overall capital expenditure hasn't really picked up, it's still running at £5 to £6 billion, which are well below the levels we saw earlier this decade.
Yeah.
I think there is an appreciation that what the OGA is seeking to achieve could yield broad benefits to all members of the industry, all operators, all resource holders in the long run.
Yeah.
But that might only be achieved by some difficult decisions where individual producers might be forced to suffer a detriment, mm-hmm. financial detriment. So I think there's a delicate role that the OGA has to play. It has to balance competing interests. There are competing pressures on it. It wants to pursue the objective of MER UK without in any way frightening the horses, as it were, by frightening off future investment. I think Tim Egger, as energy minister back in the 80s, was a the 90s,
actually, 90s.
was a strong defender of the liberal regime.
Yeah.
I think he's. There are signs that the OGA is flexing its muscles, if you like, warning that it's not going to tolerate behaviour from operators which frustrates its objective of MER UK. But I think it's going to have to play a delicate. It's going to have to play. It's going to have to be skillful and dexterous in how it approaches a lot of these questions which it's now facing. Because, quite frankly, you have a new set of investors in the North Sea who've arrived. It's not quite clear. They don't have a track record.
No.
We don't know how they're going to respond.
Yeah.
The UK in cutting taxes has made the UK more competitive, more attractive for new investment compared to some other competing regimes. But if those competing regimes also cut their tax rates, it may be that some of the benefits that the UK is currently enjoying will dissipate.
Well, as we kind of come to the end of this podcast, I would like to address the energy transition, if I may, Marshall, because we're doing a lot of work on that, of course, in the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, and the UK government's new zero emissions by 2050 target is an important element of this. So I just wondered, you know, where that lies in the kind of whole UKCS resource kind of growth. How does that overarching policy lie?
Well, I think the government, I think quite rightly, has indicated that MER UK, an obligation to maximise the economic recovery of oil and gas resources from offshore UK waters, is compatible with the UK's decarbonisation target. And that was true when the target was an 80% reduction by 2050, and I think it's equally true now of the new net zero emissions target. And indeed, the Climate Change Committee, I think, has acknowledged that is the case. What happens to the gas and what emissions are associated with it depend, of course, of whether how extensive CCS is.
But is CCS important? Because you do talk about CO2 storage at offshore locations. You know, what is the potential for that?
Well, it's clear that the UK and Norway, as offshore producers, have resources, and that's physical infrastructure, pipelines, and depleted offshore fields, depleted oil and gas fields, which could be used for CO2 transportation and storage in future. The history of CCS project development in the UK is not exactly a happy one, but it's interesting that we've had a first license for the OGA in December last year has issued a new license for CO2 transportation and storage, and there's no doubt that decarbonisation over the long period, over the long term,
yeah.
is more likely to be achieved at least cost yeah. if CO2 transportation and storage is available.
Yeah.
We have the resources
yeah.
Offshore.
Yeah.
The question is, can we make capture onshore, particularly from industrial clusters,
yeah.
economic? I think it's helpful that the way in which the CCS debate has developed in the last yeah. 5 years has tended to break this up now yeah. into capture economics and then transportation and storage economics.
Yeah.
And I think we just need to find a business model that works.
And you said throughout this podcast, you have talked about cost, you talked about economics, and that obviously links back. I'd just like to finish off quickly, but I always like to end up with this question, Marsh, and that's kind of looking to the future. You know, so now over the last 25 minutes or so, we've discussed a load of issues. By the way, your paper, I would strongly recommend to our listeners reading it. It's a really interesting read. But I suppose the ultimate question is, where are we going to end up? Where is it all going to end up on the UKCS?
Well, I think it's very difficult to contradict the view that we are in a decline period.
Yeah.
I think the changes that have been made in the last few years, I think, suggest to me at least that the decline is going to be rather less dramatic,
yeah.
rather better managed,
yeah.
and rather slower than some of the projections that we saw.
Which is good news.
Which is good news for UK energy
yeah.
supply
yeah.
security.
Yeah.
It's good news for employment,
yeah.
Onshore employment. It may not be particularly material for UK government finances now because the UK continental shelf has really ceased to be a significant contributor.
But West of Shetland could replace that, couldn't it?
Indeed, that's where the great potential lies. Both
yeah.
it's predominantly oil
yeah.
At the moment in production and the discovered resource base, but the potential for gas production
mm-hmm.
Is quite considerable west of Shetland. We just
right.
need to get the infrastructure in place. And I think that's where the OGA has a potentially important mm. role, ensuring that you get, as far as possible, an optimal mm. development of any new infrastructure or redeployment,
yeah.
reuse of existing infrastructure west of Shetland. I think elsewhere on the more mature areas of the mm. Southern Gas Basin, for example, Southern North Sea, it may be rather more difficult for the OGA to make a difference.
Mm.
And
so it comes down to economics, as we've said.
Well, it does, yes. The hard economics of costs, taxes and prices, I think, are going to remain the fundamental drivers of activity,
yeah.
investment and production on the continental shelf.
Well, on that note, I think, Dave, in fact, that last line almost summarises the whole of our discussion today. So, Marshall, I'd just like to say thank you very much for your time. You know, as always, I've really enjoyed our conversation that builds on your paper, Gas Production from the UK Continental Shelf, that can be found at our website, www.oxfordenergy.org, where you can also find all our podcasts in the multimedia folder and the other papers published by the Institute. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Goodbye.